Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Peter Hart. This week on Counterspin, disaster anniversaries are ready-made news hooks for media always in search of one. March sees 20 years since the Exxon Valdez spilled at least 11 million gallons and likely very much more of crude oil in Prince William Sound, Alaska. It's also been 30 years this month since this country's worst nuclear accident, the partial core meltdown at Pennsylvania nuclear plant Three Mile Island. Both incidents were seen as watershed revelations of institutional failures and engendered activism and calls for reform. But corporate media's looks back and lessons learned don't always identify the right lessons and rarely engage meaningfully the role of media in explaining what went wrong or how to keep it from going wrong again. We'll hear from activist and marine biologist Ricky Ott, author of Not One Drop, Betrayal and Courage in the Wake of the Exxon Valdez Oil Spill, on that story, and from Harvey Wasserman, longtime nuclear activist and co-author of the book Killing Our Own, The Disaster of America's Experience with Atomic Radiation. All that's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a look back at the week's press.
Some in the media are shaking their heads at the populist fury directed at the failed insurance giant AIG over the company paying out $165 million bonuses, much of which went to the division that was largely responsible for the company's collapse and the subsequent taxpayer bailout keeping it afloat. Among the complaints is that the media themselves have given too much critical attention to these bonuses, helping to fuel this Main Street fire. Well, don't hurl that accusation at ABC's World News with Charles Gibson. On March 17th and 18th, Gibson and financial reporter Betsy Stark stressed that public outrage was a problem. As Gibson put it, quote, "As a lot of people pointed out today, there's a real danger in this because everybody in this country has a vested interest in AIG succeeding because we, the taxpayer, essentially own the company, right?" Close quote. Stark agreed. But their advice wasn't heeded, so the following night, Gibson and Stark were at it again, with Gibson warning that, quote, "We may be driving down the value of the company we own," close quote. Stark added that taxpayers could be cutting off their noses to spite their faces. It's hard to believe these reporters really buy this. If they do, then criticism of any publicly owned or controlled enterprise is problematic. And shareholders criticizing mismanagement at corporations, a common practice, that would be dangerous too. No, what really seems to gall some establishment reporters is that there's so much anger directed at Wall Street. It's worth remembering that when Gibson moderated a Democratic debate last year, he challenged Barack Obama on his plan to raise the capital gains tax, repeating the cherished and debunked right-wing argument that lowering taxes on the wealthy increases government revenue. It's another reminder of where a reporter like Charles Gibson is coming from.
As the war in Afghanistan grinds on and, in fact, escalates, some lamentable media trends continue as well. Take the lead of a March 23rd piece in the New York Times, which told of a special forces operation that killed five people. Afghans say the dead were civilians, which the Times explained was, quote, "resurrecting a sore point that has troubled the American-led war here," close quote. Well, there's a lot to unpack there. Anger over civilian deaths is not being resurrected since it never went away. And how exactly can a war be troubled by itself? A few days before, the Times had a story about drone attacks in Afghanistan and neighboring Pakistan under the unfortunate headline, "The Downside of Letting Robots Do the Bombing." The piece downplayed impact on civilians, but noted that, quote, "even when precise, the drone strikes often kill women and children in militant compounds," close quote. When that happens, the Times reported, quote, "local Pashtun customs of Badal obligate their survivors to seek revenge," close quote. Not for the first time, then, the paper treats the desire to avenge family members' murders as some peculiar exotic custom, never seeming to question whether such bizarre attitudes and their impact might be part of what's troubling not the war, but its victims.
And finally, breaking news in the New York Times business section, it turns out some of the claims made about the wonderful impact of NAFTA were wrong. Yes, you heard it there, well, last, but there it was in the headline of a March 24th article, "NAFTA's Promise unfulfilled. The article explained that, quote, in some cases, NAFTA produced results that were exactly the opposite of what was promised, close quote. These included cases where, quote, domestic industries were dismantled as multinationals imported parts from their own suppliers, close quote, and, quote, local farmers were priced out of the market by food imported tariff-free. Many Mexican farmers simply abandoned their land and headed north, close quote. Of course, these impacts, while they may have been the opposite of what was promised by NAFTA cheerleaders, were in fact predicted by numerous economists, labor organizers, and activists who were critical of NAFTA. It's just that those people couldn't get a hearing in papers like the New York Times, which, for its part, was having reporters make statements like this from a front-page news story, mind you, quote, free trade means growth, free trade means growth, free trade means growth. Just say it 50 more times and all doubts will melt away. Close quote. Doubts you might want to hold on to include whether the Times can make a clear-eyed assessment of NAFTA even years later.
Thank you, Peter. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. The Exxon Valdez supertanker spilled millions and millions of gallons of crude oil into Prince William Sound, Alaska, in March of 1989, devastating not just landscape, but livelihoods, as well as numerous kinds of fish, birds, seals, and other species that have not recovered. From Exxon's initial declaration of the event as an act of God, it was clear the corporation would go big in its PR offensive, and years of legal delays and manipulations have borne that out. So what about journalists? Have they held industry claims up to the sort of scrutiny necessary to keep something like the Exxon Valdez from happening again? We're joined now by Ricky Ott. Ricky Ott has years now of activism on the impact of the Valdez disaster and is author, most recently, of Not One Drop, Betrayal and Courage in the Wake of the Exxon Valdez Oil Spill. She joins us now by phone. Welcome to Counterspin, Ricky Ott.
Thank you very much.
Well, anniversaries tend to be about the past and how far we've come. I guess I'd first like you to address to what degree the Exxon Valdez oil spill is a live story as opposed to something that happened 20 years ago.
We still do not have the herring back in Prince William Sound. Herring are a foundational species in Prince William Sound. They're the forage fish that whales, seals, sea lions, seabirds all rely on. Realistically, without herring, Prince William Sound cannot recover. So we are waiting for the herring to recover. And they collapsed in 1989 when the young of the year did not survive their oil bath. And 4 years later when those fish should have become adults, they weren't there. And that's when the population crashed. We also rely on herring for our economy. So there are still fishermen. To this day, the herring fishermen, it's closed indefinitely. They are out of that line of work. We are still incurring long-term harm from something that happened 20 years ago now. So that's the sort of the environmental and economic side, but there's more. And this is kind of where it's in the interest of all Americans to really understand what happened. In our Supreme Court decision back in June of 2008, the Supreme Court decided to break the link between punishment and profit. The jury had decided that it would really take a link between punishment and profit to punish a corporation this big. $5 billion was 1 year's net profit in 1994. The Supreme Court decided no, punishment should instead be linked to damages. And as I've just explained, we were only compensated for short-term damages. But this set precedent now, this capping of punitive damages to a one-to-one ratio of punitive to compensatory, this makes every community in America vulnerable to corporate greed. And the most, let's stay with Exxon Valdez, if $5 billion had indeed been punishment, then Exxon should have been the first company to double hull its tanker fleet and make them safer, rather than the last. And what we see now is Exxon, of the top 10 oil shippers, Exxon has more single hull tankers afloat in the world's ocean than the other nine companies combined, all to earn its shareholders an extra penny a year on their stocks.
On that hulling note, I was interested in the New York Times editorial that kind of declared matter-of-factly that supertankers are now double-hulled because of the Valdez. They made it sound as though that policy flowed sort of naturally and immediately from the disaster, and that's not at all how it went. I mean, you've just indicated that the company that ought to have gone straight to double-hulling, Exxon, is lagging, and it's been a lot of activism that has made the other companies take the steps that they've had, hasn't it?
It's only been activism. Congress passed the Oil Pollution Act of 1990 that requires double-hull tankers by the year 2015. That essentially gave these big, powerful oil companies 25 years to try to weaken and reduce that standard, and try they have. And it's the only thing that has kept that standard. There were two things. One was citizen oversight, citizen activism, also required by the Oil Pollution Act of 1990. It pushed back each end run that the oil companies tried four times. And finally, the Prestige and the Erica oil spills in Spain and France sealed the deal when the international community just got outraged and demanded double-hull tankers by the year 2012. The fleet is largely shifting over, and again, it's then Exxon, who's the most recalcitrant company of all.
So if the theme is lessons learned, I guess maybe the most important lessons have to do with activism. Well, let me ask you, you've watched media operate now in Alaska and nationally for decades now, and you describe a process that I've heard you call media capture. What do you mean by that? How does that work?
I was shocked to see how easily these big oil companies, in this case Exxon, could make its story the dominant story in the news. And this has actually driven me to write two books trying to correct 20 years of wrongheadedness by the media. The lies started on day one. I landed in Valdez, and within 12 hours of the grounding, I was down with the federal scientists, the NOAA people, and they were estimating the size of the spill based on, you know, computer modeling, and it was between 11, low-end estimate, million gallons, to 38 million gallons. Exxon captured the low-end number. When the press started asking, I was in the room watching. Who validated that? Who verified that? Exxon spokesperson Frank Iarossi kind of threw out that alcohol may have been involved, quote. And just like that, I watched the national media switch tracks like a railroad, mm-hmm. and it became 11 million gallons ever since that day. The reason that's important, and I knew it would be, was because penalties are based on spill volume.
Right.
And correction measures based on spill volume. So what do we have in Alaska right now? We are prepared to respond to an Exxon Valdez oil size oil spill, which means three times less than what really spilled.
Than what actually happened. Well, that 11 yep. million is what you're, or even 10.8 is what is on the record. That's what's being reported in the anniversary coverage. Well, in 1989, FAIR did a study of the McNeil-Lehrer NewsHour, then as now considered among the most serious news programs. And between February and August of that year, they did seven segments on the Valdez spill, not one of which included an environmentalist. Debate on that show was illustrated by the then chairman of Exxon and the governor of Alaska, who sat down to have a cozy conversation in which the governor of Alaska said that the chairman of Exxon was being far too heavy on his own company. So we found that a kind of top-down bias in media, talking to just the corporate officials and government officials, really left out what were the key perspectives at the time.
And, you know, it's not just at the time. That's another mm-hmm. huge problem, is that these stories evolved. The killing did not stop in 1989. Well, where was the media to cover the 1992 Pink Salmon Run collapse, 1993 Pink Salmon Run collapse? I mean, we actually held a blockade of Valdez Narrows, held up oil tanker traffic. That brought in the media and attention, and it started the ecosystem studies, which took 10 years to complete, and now we know that oil is more toxic than we thought. And where is the news on this? This should be tied into the debates right now on global climate crisis. Do we need to get off oil? Not only for the sake of the planet, but also that this stuff is much more toxic than we thought in the 1970s when we passed the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act. We're talking 1% of a child's lung capacity for every 1 year of their life just by breathing urban air that the federal government regulates as safe and is not. Bush administration standards are now being challenged by Obama, and this is the fine soot standard. This is polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, the fraction of oil that we now know causes long-term harm mm-hmm. in wildlife and in people.
Let me ask you, how then do we sanction corporations that commit acts of devastation like that of the Valdez?
Well, I would like to see us take a good look at what we've done with these big corporations. We have given them, through the Supreme Court, rights that were only intended for humans. We have created literally a monster in our midst. We have created a way to consolidate wealth and power and privilege that is destroying our ability to hold these companies accountable. So I am advocating coalescing this sort of unrest across the nation that we saw starting with WTO protests in Seattle into a citizen movement and to pass the 28th Amendment to the Constitution, stripping corporations of human rights. This gets to the heart of campaign abuse, the legal system abuse, lack of enforcement of our law officials, and actually strikes at the heart of globalization. And to find more about that, please have, and I invite folks to come to ultimatecivics.com, 21st Century Civil Rights Movement, Human Rights versus Corporate Rights.
All right, then. I'd like to thank you very much for joining us today. We've been speaking with author and activist Dr. Ricky Ott. Again, you can follow her work on these issues at the website ultimatecivics.com. Thank you very much for joining us this week on Counterspin, Ricky Ott.
You're welcome, Janine.
Well, from one environmental catastrophe to another, the 30th anniversary of the Three Mile Island meltdown in Pennsylvania offers an opportunity to look at the spin in the media at the time of the incident and the way history has been written or rewritten over the years. While media accounts seem to agree that the partial meltdown at the Pennsylvania site was a serious disaster, the lesson we're supposed to learn is that it could have been worse and that it shouldn't cloud our thinking about nuclear power some 30 years down the road. We're joined now by Harvey Wasserman. And he's a longtime nuclear activist, journalist, and author of many books, the most recent being Solartopia, Our Green-Powered Earth, AD 2030. Harvey Wasserman, welcome to Counterspin.
Great to be with you.
Now, the legacy of the Three Mile Island disaster for much of the corporate media is that it was more of a PR disaster than anything else. On Earth Day 1997, the PBS show Frontline told us no one was injured or killed. The New York Times Magazine, 10 years later, told us the same thing and said we were confusing a Jane Fonda movie with reality. John Stossel at ABC, no surprise, told us a few years ago that the amount of radiation that people in the area were exposed to was meaningless. A March 22nd column in the Washington Post again explained no one died and the health consequences were insignificant. What do you make of all of that?
Utter nonsense. I mean, the fact is that nobody knows how much radiation escaped from Three Mile Island. And nobody knows where it went. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission has admitted in front of Congress that they don't know where it went. And we just had a study released yesterday at Three Mile Island saying that a nuclear engineer has looked at it 30 years later and believes that far more radiation, as much as 100 times more radiation, escaped than was originally believed. They have put out estimates, but they are meaningless. And there was one PR sort of a flyer that was put out by the utility company saying essentially that everybody in the area got the equivalent of a chest x-ray. Mm-hmm. Well, if that was true, that means that they x-rayed all the pregnant women in the area, and we have long since stopped x-raying pregnant women because a single x-ray can be catastrophic to a fetus or an embryo in utero. So I went into the Three Mile Island area the year after the accident, and I conducted dozens of interviews with local people, and it was the worst week of my life. People were complaining of cancers, leukemias, birth defects, rashes, hair loss, lesions, a metallic taste in their mouth, which we correlated to similar reports at nuclear bomb tests, and actually among the pilots who dropped the bomb on Hiroshima. There is absolutely no doubt that Three Mile Island killed people, and now, 30 years later, we still have 2,400 families who filed a class action lawsuit in the 1980s after the accident, demanding compensation, and they have yet to have their case heard.
Well, the reporting we see today tells us that Three Mile Island was a bad day for the power industry, and they've had a hard time recovering and so on. I wanted to ask you about the coverage at the time of the disaster. Thanks to YouTube, we can see Walter Cronkite's report on CBS Evening News, and he opened with these words, "The world has never known a day quite like today. It faced the considerable uncertainties and dangers of the worst nuclear power plant accident of the atomic age, and the horror tonight is that it could get much worse." Close quote. The conventional wisdom, I guess, now is that there was a panic back then. Do you recall the coverage being particularly alarmist?
Well, it was, because it was accurate to be alarmed. I mean, the fact is there was a hydrogen bubble inside the nuclear reactor that could have exploded. Ironically, one of the things that may have saved the northeast of the United States from a massive radiation release is that when Three Mile Island Unit 2 was being built, people in the area fought it tooth and nail, and one of the things they demanded was that since Three Mile Island is directly in the flight path of the Harrisburg Airport, they demanded that the containment dome be reinforced. And so the containment dome at Three Mile Island Unit 2 was actually one of the strongest in the world, and that may, ironically enough, have prevented a crack in the containment that would have done everything that Walter Cronkite was warning about. I also should point out that, you know, there were demonstrations at nuclear plants in the years beginning in 1976 at Seabrook, New Hampshire. And had it not been for the mass demonstrations at Seabrook and other nuclear plants, including, by the way, Three Mile Island, people were opposed to that reactor, no one would have paid the slightest attention to this accident. No one would have known really what was going on. We had had a previous accident that was potentially much worse at the Fermi 1 unit in Monroe, Michigan, in 1966. And the officials, the authorities were actually on the brink of trying to evacuate Detroit during that accident, but nobody heard about it. I was in Ann Arbor at the time, and I didn't read about the accident for 7 years. So the panic that was put out by the media in 1979 was actually very, very well-founded, because it could have been an apocalyptic event.
We've heard this with other issues, and certainly with this one, that activism pushes the media to a place where they probably wouldn't have been. How quickly did the industry PR effort kind of take control of the story? Because the looks back seem to be dominated by this industry-friendly perspective.
Well, immediately, of course. They had all the money. But one of the great ironies also of media history is that the accident coincided with the release of the China Syndrome movie from Jane Fonda, Michael Douglas, and Jack Lemmon. And that movie certainly would not have been made had it not been for the demonstrations at Diablo Canyon in California and in Seabrook and so on. In fact, I was on the set of the China Syndrome and gave a little bit of advice here and there on the movie. So the joke was that all the anchors, including Walter Cronkite, were running the Sea to China Syndrome in the daytime so they could do their reports at night. But the battle for control of the story is really ongoing. I mean, the fact of the matter is that people were killed at Three Mile Island, and this is a lethal assertion for an industry that's trying to, you know, make its way back with a renaissance.
I want to ask you about that. We've talked about that so-called renaissance of nuclear power before on Counterspin. It seems every few years the industry mounts a campaign touting its own comeback. It seems that this would only work if people either forget Three Mile Island or accept the line that it either wasn't so bad or that something like that simply cannot happen again.
Well, I love it when they say Three Mile Island was a success story, because what they overlook is that the asset at Three Mile Island Unit 2 was assessed at $900 million. And within, you know, a matter of minutes, a $900 million asset was turned into a multi-billion dollar liability. If that's the kind of success we're looking at, then it's no accident that the country's in a recession or a depression after all these years. I mean, the reality is that the nuclear industry cannot get private financing. And one of the reasons is Three Mile Island. They also cannot get private insurance. Had TMI been much, much worse, and several trillion dollars worth of damage had been done, which could have been done, could also have been done on September 11th when the jets flew into the World Trade Center. If they had flown into nuclear plants instead, this country would be in permanent bankruptcy. And all that is covered by federal liability insurance, because after 50 years, the nuclear power industry cannot get private coverage. And that was the case at Three Mile Island.
What do you think people should be thinking about as this anniversary is marked by the media?
Well, we are at a breaking point now. I mean, people like to say we're at crossroads about just about everything, but the fact is that the renewable energy industry, the solartopian technologies of wind, solar, tidal, geothermal, increased efficiency have now really emerged as major powers in the marketplace. And aside from all the radioactive dangers, we have, and also, by the way, it's a major landmark now with the abandonment of the Yucca Mountain, proposed waste dump at Yucca Mountain. This is also a multi-decade project, and after 50 years, with the abandonment by the Department of Energy and Obama and Harry Reid of Nevada of this idea of taking high-level nuclear waste to Nevada, the nuclear industry has nothing. After a half century, there is no plan whatsoever to do anything with the high-level nuclear waste except to let it sit there. So with the failure of Yucca Mountain and this last-ditch attempt by the nuclear industry to get federal funding to build new reactors, we really are looking at, in a year or two, if we can stop them, there will be no future for nuclear power whatsoever. This is the last gasp of the nuclear industry, which is one of the reasons they're so desperate to deny the impact of TMI on the health impacts, on the health of the people in central Pennsylvania. But I got to tell you, I have been there. I have interviewed the people. It is not something you want to do. The health impacts were devastating, both on people and on animals. And the biggest lie in industrial history in the United States remains this idea that no one was killed there. And what we really need to do is have the 2,400 families who filed their class action suit in the 1980s finally get their day in court, and then we'll see what really happened.
We've been speaking with Harvey Wasserman, longtime nuclear activist, journalist, and author of many books, including Killing Our Own, The Disaster of America's Experience with Atomic Radiation. His most recent is Solartopia, Our Green-Powered Earth, AD 2030. He's also the editor of nukefree.org, which is one of the many places you can read his latest column, People Died at 3 Mile Island. Harvey Wasserman, thanks for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Hey, thank you.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the staff and interns at FAIR, the National Media Watch Group, based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them on FAIR's website, www.fair.org. The show is engineered by Kelly Spivey at Mercer Media. With me is Peter Hart. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.